Hello, my name is Jonathan Seatler and welcome to the fifth agenda. My agenda today is that rites of light is witchcraft. Now, obviously, before embarking on that agenda, I need to define what witchcraft is. Witchcraft is a set of ancient beliefs and superstitions shrouded in mystery, often misused, and likely to cause great distress. And rites of light are like that as well. I'll tell you why. First of all, there are very high barriers to understanding. It's quite hard to get into the lingo, the jargon of rites of light. And to say there are very high barriers to understanding, of course, is a polite way of saying there's more than a whiff of mumbo jumbo about it all. The second thing is, a lot of rites of light lore is based on very old rules, and we've lost all recollection of why they were needed in the first place. The Prescription Act 1832, which has been on the statute book now for nearly 200 years, is so poorly drafted, it's almost impossible to read from beginning to end. Third similarity with witchcraft is that rites of light can be very, very important indeed. Genesis itself, the Bible itself, opens with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Darkness lay on the surface of the deep." And then God says, "Let there be light," and there was light. It's pretty fundamental, light. It's everything. And witchcraft was important too, certainly when females were thrown into rivers to see if they drowned and were only considered innocent if they did, it was pretty important to them. The fifth similarity is that, like witchcraft, rites of light creates a lot of fear. The sixth similarity is everybody knows we have to change it, but nobody has agreed quite how. The Law Commission has put out, between 2008 and 2014, four separate publications about rights to light, and yet nothing has been changed. And the final similarity between witchcraft and rites of light is it's impossible to locate the real expertise on it. Lawyers and surveyors pass the buck between them, or, if they're not doing that, are treading on each other's toes. So, with me to debate my agenda, which is that rites of light is witchcraft, is Emma Humphreys, a partner in Charles Russell Speechley, well known for many aspects of property litigation, but especially rights of light. She's an honorary member of ARBRICS on the RICS Telecoms Forum and is a former chair of the PLA Training and Education Committee. She has also sat on the steering group of the RICS Dilapidations Forum and the Southeast Committee of Women in Property. Hello, Emma.
Morning, Jonathan.
So what do you think? My agenda is that this is witchcraft.
Well, unsurprisingly, I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree with you. I'm quite interested, actually, in your reference to rites of light being so ancient that actually they're now irrelevant or pointless somehow. And your reference to the Bible, I think, is quite apt, because just because the Ten Commandments were handed down a long time ago doesn't make them any less relevant today. I think, you know, thou shalt not commit murder is probably still quite effective rule to have. So I don't think that something, because it's old, that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't work. And in fact, quite to the contrary, because if it's been working all this time and we've had these rules, then actually one might argue, if it isn't broke, don't try and fix it.
Okay, I would absolutely love to debate theology with you, Emma. I think it would be fantastic entertainment. But unfortunately, we're only here to talk about rites of light. So, this is the thing. Why can't we just sweep away the whole stupid, difficult, bitty subject and impose a system like the Party Warlock system, get rid of injunctions and replace the whole thing with insurance?
Well, I think, I mean, insurance is a good point, because I think insurance is actually filling a gap where there is a lack of certainty. I think it's doing a really good job. I mean, the Party Wall Act, you know, I've thought about this as well. You know, should we have something along those lines? But actually, you're still going to need the involvement of specialists. You're still going to need a specialist rights of light surveyor. And I think because of rights of light, you're still going to need legal involvement, probably far more than you tend to see with party walls. So I'm not sure it's really, you know, I'm not sure that approach would actually achieve anything, you know, in terms of trying to make it more certain or reduce costs. I'm not sure that gets us there. And you yourself said, you know, the Law Commission having to publish all these various ideas that it's had, I think that shows by its very, you know, just the very fact of that shows this is difficult. You know, this is difficult to try to change. And I'm afraid, you know, with what I've seen being produced by Parliament in recent years, frankly, I don't trust them to do a decent enough job at it.
Okay. When I've got clients with rights of light issues, like when you have, I bet you we get asked the same question. And the question is this going to be injunctable? Right, that's the thing that everybody wants to know. A developer wants to know, is this going to be injunctable?
Yes.
And a person with the benefit of a right of light is going to want to know, is this injunctable so I can muck up the development and therefore get right? Why? One of the things that I've never really fully appreciated is why we need injunctions. What purpose do you think injunctions are fulfilling? I mean, they're a major part of the law in this area, but would it be the end of the world if we just swept away injunctions and said, you can't get injunctions for right of light, you just get money?
Well, I mean, we have that ability, don't we, under the Housing and Planning Act. You've got Section 203. So in appropriate cases, that's exactly what a local authority with a developer can do. But I think that would, I mean, you know, why are rights of light so special compared to any other area?
Yeah, this you
is
tell
a,
me.
Yeah, well, this is about balancing interests, isn't it? It's about balancing the interests of those who want to do a development and those who are affected by the development. And if you said, oh, we're not having injunctions for rights of light, well, OK, fine, but what about the people who've got the benefit of restrictive covenants? I mean, how far are we going to take this?
Okay, that's so you're basically saying you're right that you don't need injunctions, but think of the knock-on effects, because you wouldn't be able to get an injunction for going on someone's right of way.
I don't think I am saying you're right that we shouldn't have injunctions. I mean, I think injunctions are an important remedy, and I think it would be a major change to our whole system of law if people weren't able to get an injunction in appropriate circumstances. And let's, you know, not forget, they're not handing out injunctions willy-nilly here. You know, if you look at the rights of light cases, you know, they're not being handed out like sweeties. So I don't think that that's quite right. And I also actually think you're right when you say, obviously, it's a key question when people come to talk to you about rights of light, you know, is it injunctable? Which I have to say, I really hate that phrase because it's such a balancing exercise. But actually, I think in the last 10 years or so, that question has altered slightly because developers are better informed. I think actually how they approach it these days is, how are we going to get the development done? You know, who's got rights that, you know, actually need to be taken account of, and how are we going to approach those issues? I think the days of steaming in and overriding people's rights and worrying about it later, you know, obviously, you know, that was Midtown really was the last time that happened. I think those days have gone. And I'm not sure that's such a bad thing, because actually, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if that developer had its own property affected, it would want to act. I mean, hence the reason you get into these mutual agreements and things. You know, people who have rights, you know, tend to like to have the ability to protect them.
But would it be the end of the world if we didn't have injunctions? I mean, why can't the benefit of the right just be monetized? It would make it so much simpler. You see, I'll tell you why. Because you know as well as I do that when a client asks, will this be injunctable, you can never give a clear answer. You can never say yes or no. I guarantee that there will be no injunction granted, despite the fact that you're taking light from about six different buildings around you. I guarantee that you never hear any lawyer say that.
Mm.
So the thing is that injunctions are at the heart of this subject, and yet you can never give a clear answer to the basic question. And so what's the utility? I mean, anything that you can't answer the most basic question about, you've got to say that needs some changing because it's got no utility.
But then I think you're getting into the point about injunctions as a whole. It's not specific to rights of light. You know, I think that's the case with all types of injunction. You know, it's a discretionary remedy, isn't it? It's a balancing exercise, whatever the context. So really what you're arguing for is, let's just get rid of injunctions as a remedy, full stop.
Yeah, but there's a big difference, right? The difference is that you have things, and, you know, if an alien came from another planet, they'd be amazed. But you have things called rights of light surveyors, rights of light experts. Now, you don't get rights of way experts or easement to park experts, right? This is the only area where you've got experts whose life's work is dedicated to pronouncing on loss of light. And what they often do, these rights of light experts, many of whom I love and adore, nevertheless, what they often do is say, well, that infringement is injunctable, that infringement is not injunctable. And you and I know that nobody can give that level of certainty. And so one of the reasons why this is different from other areas is it's grown its own little mini industry. It's grown, it's sprouted people who have made it their life's work. And as a result, it's got very, very complex.
I don't agree that it's got that complex, actually. I mean, it's a case of, you know, looking at whether people have got rights of light, and obviously there's legal and historic issues there. Then, you know, you assess the position and measure, you know, how much light there is and how much it's going to be infringed. I have to say, when you look at the cases, there doesn't seem to be really that much dispute between surveyors mostly about that, actually, when it comes down to it. I'm not sure that's right. And, you know, you've picked a couple of areas where, you know, maybe you don't get such experts. But, I mean, we have experts in most areas of law. You know, you've got a boundary dispute. There's people who are experts in that sort of thing. You've got DLAPs. You've got specialist experts. I think it's a positive thing that you have these experts who are able to measure it with a high degree of certainty of how the development is going to affect the room. And then they work out, you know, where that gets us. As I say, I think you're just coming back to the same point. You're coming back to the point that you don't like injunctions. But that would be a fundamental shift. And I don't think it's right to say that because there are specialist experts, you know, if we get rid of injunctions, that's not going to change that.
Okay, I've just written down one thing you've said because I just couldn't believe you'd said it. And so I wrote it down in order that it should look back at me and prove to me that you've said it. You said, you're talking about rights of light. You said, I don't agree it's got complex. I mean, seriously, you may as well have said Jimmy Savile's got an unfairly bad press. I mean, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard you say. I don't agree that rights of light has got complex. I mean, look, I'll show you. I'll ask you a question about rights of light. And if you can answer this question, right, if you can answer this question, then I might begin to accept that you're onto something. A tenant can have a right of light. Do you agree?
Yes, I do.
It's basically a leasehold easement. When the lease ends, does the easement end? Or can the benefit inure for the new tenant and the burden inure for the existing landlord?
The benefit continues for the existing landlord and the rights of the tenant will depend on what its new lease says.
Right. So you think that's the answer to
that
question?
I just think, you know, it's funny because also in your introduction you said about, you know, there were barriers to understanding. You know, let's take, for example, by way of comparison, employment law, OK? So whenever I go near employment law and I think, oh, it must be that, I mean, that would be the obvious thing, it's always the opposite. It is never what I think it is. And yet let's look at how many more people are affected in this country by employment rights. And yet the law there, I think, is, you know, often illogical and actually quite complex to understand. So, I mean, we can say this about any area, and I think for any non-lawyer, law is difficult. I mean, you know, frankly, that's why we all went and studied for years and years, and we are constantly learning. So, you know, I like to think that what we do is quite challenging. I would agree with that. But I don't think, you know, any area of law, I mean, look how they're struggling with Brexit. Any area of law is complicated. And rights of light are absolutely, yes, of course, they can be challenging for a non-lawyer, they can be challenging for lawyers. But I don't think that it's actually so complex that, you know, that we can't cope. I mean, I just think that's a nonsense.
Well, obviously, I recognise the importance of you changing the subject to talk about employment law in answer to my question about leasehold easements. Let me ask you another question about rights of light. If you can answer this question correctly, then I think I may begin to consider your position. I don't agree it's got complex. I'll read that again. I don't agree it's got complex. Right, this is the question. Why should I, as an occupier of an office, get money or an injunction for loss of light when I can simply turn the light on?
Because that's not what you've contracted for, is it? You know, you've taken your office space as it is. You probably quite liked the light. And, you know, if you've negotiated your lease actually so that you are the person who still has the rights of light, then, you know, that I think that's fair enough.
I've got light in the ceiling.
Oh. Yeah, but you know what? This comes back, because this came up in Midtown, and I remember reading that judgment and thinking, what's that got to do with it? And I know it's come up in the consultations and what have you, but artificial light is exactly that. It's artificial. And I think also, the other thing I think we have to bear in mind with rights of light, and I completely understand why it's been looked at, and I completely get that people would like to, you know, wave a magic wand and make it all better. But actually, we've got to think also about the future. And the future of this market, the future of real estate, is changing. And one of the things that's becoming really important to tenants, that tenant, for example, you give in your example, you know, is well-being. And it could be that well-being is going to be a key factor in the market value of properties going forward. We've already got the WELL standard. One of the seven factors there is light. You know, it's no good just saying, oh, well, you can switch the light on. Okay, so let's put it this way. We're in a dark room now. Would you...
Hang on. People will get the wrong impression. Well, first of all, we're in a recording studio.
Yes, and
right?
It's dark.
Well, that's because it's very sunny outside, mm-hmm. and there are shades blocking the light. By the way, Midtown, wasn't that near where your office was at the time?
Our old office was there,
right,
yeah.
Fetter Lane,
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did it not concern... One of the buildings that lost light was what is now the Rolls Building.
Yes, I suppose that's probably right, isn't it? Yeah, and it was Kendall Freeman's own, DJ Freeman, whatever they were called then. It was their offices.
It was their offices
that were that bit.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it caused a loss of light to various buildings, to include the Rolls Building, what is now the Rolls Building, contributed to a loss of light in the Rolls Building. Correct.
I think that is correct. I remember DJ Freeman more, because obviously I'm more interested in the solicitors.
Yeah. And do you remember the judge on Midtown? Do you remember who that was?
Peter Smith.
Peter Smith. And the word on the street is, you know, because he allowed the light infringement, didn't he?
Yes.
The word on the street is that when the civil courts went over to the Rolls Building, he was given a room at the back of the Rolls Building that suffered from low light because of his decision in Midtown. Isn't that amazing?
That's fabulous. But this comes back to my point. So this comes back to my point, okay, because, and in fact, I can give you a really practical example of this. But, you know, I give this example because we're sitting in this room, the blinds are down, it's quite dark. You know, it's fine for a half-hour recording and what have you, but you wouldn't want to work all day in these conditions. And I give you a practical example of that. I've just been involved in refitting out our ninth floor of the building, which is a fabulous floor, great views across Farringdon, etc.
Oh, what, a ninth floor?
Ninth floor.
Oh, ninth.
Level nine, yeah.
Okay.
And so the ninth floor of our building, highest floor of our building, great views on one side. So on one side of the building, fabulous light, fabulous views, great. On the other half, we have a building next door, almost immediately next door. Now, I have sat in various seats around this building. I've been there, moved in about 10 years ago. So I've been there 10 years. I've sat on various floors in various locations. And so when we started the design process, the first thing that we said to the architects was, nobody is sitting in an office on the dark side of the building. So everybody on that floor sits on the light side. And what we have on the dark side are, you know, meeting rooms where people aren't going to be sitting for very long. So what I'm saying is, you know, it's no good just saying, well, you know, you can switch the light on. If you've got to work in it all day, every day, you know, I could produce a number of colleagues who would say that actually light is very important. And if you remember in Midtown, that's exactly what happened. Witnesses got into the witness box, solicitor witnesses, saying, actually, you know, I like my light.
Okay. I've got one other aspect I want to... I'm still looking at this expression, I don't agree it's got complex. Because Emma Humphreys wants to tell the world that the law of rights to light is an intellectual walk in the park. Let me raise another subject. Measuring damages.
Yes.
Right. Now, you get damages based on the calculation of the loss of light to your room, to your property, right? But in some cases, you can also get negotiation damages, can't you?
Yeah.
Here's the question. Can you get them in every case?
Oh, that is a question. Sorry, I thought you were continuing.
No.
I thought you had a list.
No. Can you get them in every? Can you get negotiation damages in every case? And if not, why not?
Well, negotiation damages is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because we've had Maurice Garner recently emphasising exceptional circumstances should be when negotiating damages are awarded. And I think, you know, I mean, it's definitely an area, I completely agree, it's definitely an area, negotiating damages, where the law is yet to develop when it comes to rights of light.
I agree, it's got that. Complex. Is that what you're talking?
I'm not saying it's not complex, though, is it? You know, you're going to argue this in various areas of law now, especially following Maurice Garner. I mean, there's been indications about Section 84 and restrictive covenants and how it might work there. You know, the law is evolving. That's what the law does. And, you know, the point is, at the moment, everybody seems to be quite happily calculating damages. I mean, if you look at the Law Commission, what they said in their consultation was they weren't going to interfere with the measurement of damages.
Yeah. Let's explain to everyone what negotiation damages are. Basically, negotiation damages is where you say, yeah, I know I've lost a little bit of light, but because you're doing such a massive development, I could have, if you'd have come to me first, negotiated with you a much bigger sum than the value of the loss of my light, because you needed to do this massive development and the sums that were at stake were really high. That's what negotiation damages are. And so you're saying it's not complex rights of light law, it's quite simple, but the law's in a state of evolution and therefore I can't really tell whether you can get them in every case. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
But also, you've got to see the benefits of flexibility. I mean, you know, this is the other great thing, I think, with the law. You know, you can say, oh, I think we should clarify all of this. And in fact, I'm going to get my prop out now. So this is my prop I've brought with me today.
Magic wand.
I've brought my magic wand.
Okay.
So because that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
You want to wave a magic wand over it all,
yeah,
make it all better, which I have to say is putting a high degree of trust in parliamentary drafting, which I don't think is well placed. But actually, the reality is the current law is flexible. And what it enables the court to do is apply the rules in the different circumstances and award the appropriate remedy. I mean, you know, Ottercroft, I think, was a really good example of that. You know, there you've got a developer, and this is the problem with a lot of what you're saying, Jonathan, you know, the idea of, you know, let's get rid of injunctions and what have you. You know, the problem is that's all fine if you've got people who are going to behave properly. But Ottercroft was an absolute example of a developer who had behaved really badly, had tried to steal a march on the neighbour in the most sneaky way. And when that happens, you know, it is right that actually people do have remedies to call on. And so I just think, you know, you can wave your wand and say we should have a better way of calculating damages and what have you. But every time government tries to put things like that down, it doesn't work.
Right.
And it just ends up with more argument. You're not going to clarify things getting Parliament to draft
it. I'm going to clarify it now.
You're telling me I couldn't speak over you. Now you're speaking over me.
Yeah, I'm speaking over you now. Because I can't take any more of this hypocrisy. Let me ask you this question. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
My Weetabix, as always.
Right. How long have you been having Weetabix for breakfast?
Since I was about 7 years old.
Do you think you're in a position to lecture me about flexibility?
Now, listen, I have crunchy nut cornflakes occasionally at the weekend.
Yeah. Now then, let me talk to you about this magic wand that you've brought in. Which is brilliant on a podcast.
I know, I'm
actually.
Sorry, it's a podcast.
Fantastic.
It's so wasted.
No, we've got to get a States Gazette
so
to put
wasted.
Us on telly, haven't we? But
maybe we'll do a selfie at the end, and then we can put it on.
That's a good question. That's a good point. let's be serious, because your fans want a bit of seriousness.
Yes, let's be serious.
What about this as an idea? Let's see if we can compromise on this. Scrap the entire law relating to rights of light going back centuries. Say the whole thing is illegal and replace it with just one thing, which is an extended section 237 of the Town and Country Planning Act, whereby if the local authority gives planning permission, it automatically authorises the infringement of the right of light. Why don't we just nationalise the whole stupid thing?
If we had a better planning system and better people in charge of planning, I might be tempted to agree with you. But I'm not sure if you said to developers, would you like this all left in the hand of planners? I'm not sure they would feel very comfortable with that either. I mean, it would have the benefit of a one-stop shop. Again, you know, you think about alternatives, you think, is there a better way of doing this? Doing it via the planning system is definitely something worth thinking about. But I don't think we're going to lead I don't think it's going to end up with greater certainty. And you could end up, in fact, with even more dissatisfaction. I mean, for example, I mean, you know, my neighbour put a planning application in this time last year, and I was away on a 3-week holiday, so I didn't have the chance to object. Now, is that fair? I mean, luckily it didn't bother me, but, you know, rights of light, I think, are too important to fit within the existing planning process, certainly, and I think you would have to do quite a lot of change. And as I've said, the problem is you then get into drafting new rules, everybody then argues about the new rules, and I'm not sure you're further forward.
Yeah, I agree with that. It is important, which is why I think it's similar to witchcraft. Emma Humphreys, thank you very, very much for debating my agenda. It's been real.